Good morning, everyone. My name is Noel Radomski. I'm the director of WISCAPE. Thank you very much for coming this morning. Let me give you a few brief introductions of our first presenter and then the panel, and then we'll get started immediately. First, I want to thank Daniel Okoli. He's going to give a brief presentation on refining the UW-Madison campus. And here's a little information on Daniel's background. From 2001 through 2005, Daniel was the university architect at Pace University, where he was charged with managing and executing Pace's master plan and for developing new building design standards. For 6 years before that, he was an architect in Ohio State University's Office of Facilities Development, Office of Facilities Planning and Development. While there, he provided leadership on a joint university task force with the City of Columbus aimed at addressing the impact of high volume of large construction projects. Sounds familiar. After Dan's presentation, we'll have a discussion and a question and answer session with our other panelist. Gary Brown is the Director of Campus Planning and Landscape Architecture. Gary has been with the UW system for more than 22 years. He served for 15 years with the UW system offices as a landscape architect and facilities planner when he traveled around the state's 26 campus system developing master plans. Since 1999, Gary has been in the campus planning office at UW-Madison, where he now serves as the Director of Campus Planning and Landscape Architecture, overseeing the development of the campus master plan. Last, and certainly not least, Alan Fish. Alan is the Associate Vice Chancellor for Facilities, Planning, and Management. Alan has 30 years of experience with the state and UW-Madison. He has extensive experience in budgeting, planning, financing, and managing public facilities. We forgot to insert politics in here. Yeah, that's right. It's the umbrella. Before his work with the university, Alan served in several different capacities in state executive administration as well as in the state legislature. At Facilities Planning and Management, Alan provides leadership in evaluating and meeting the campus's facilities needs and represents the university on all facilities and construction matters before the public, UW system administration, local, state, and federal governments. With that, I'm pleased to introduce Daniel, and then after his presentation, Gary and Alan. Daniel?
Thanks, Noah. Is this on?
Put it up a little higher.
Can you hear me?
Yep.
Oh, good. Okay. Well, thank you for coming. Presentation is intended to be informal conversation about refining the UW-Madison campus and the work we're doing, and we title it "Beneficent Beauty." The purpose of this is to elicit some input and as we go through our question and answer, and this is clearly work in progress, but it's the direction that we're going. So that way, we can hear what you're thinking and benefit from your input as we move forward. I'd like to frame this conversation around one question. What should our campus look and feel like in the near and long term? Before I begin to talk about that, I was at a conference we hosted, a SCOP conference, and I saw some pictures, that I wanted to share. It's not from our campus. Earlier on, we decided that all of our presentation would just take examples from our campus. There are lots of examples from other campuses. But I saw a good example of something that I wanted to throw up there for conversation as we go forward. This is a building at the McFadden Hall. This is built in 1919 at Otterburn College. And then in the 60s, there was some renovation and addition. And so this is what happened, that this, Well, I thought this had a pointer in it, is it? Does this have a pointer? No, okay. No, I'm just trying to, get rid of that thing. Thank you. All right. This building is this building. So in the 1960s, you could see it, and they basically closed up some of these windows and put these other windows in there. And there were things like that. And this is the addition at the back of the building. So I suspect the story they told is that, you know, this was wasteful of energy. And so in order to save heating costs, they closed it up and have this little window. I suspect that the designer just wanted the rest of the building to match what they're adding at the back. That's the addition at the back. I think that's dumb. And we made our own share of mistakes, but I don't think quite that dramatic. So they come back in 2008, and then they went back. You know, this is, you know, portions of that existing building. That's a new addition, and then they reversed all of that. They peeled back. The reason I kind of, threw that up there, somebody basically asked me the question that there were, we made a lot of mistakes in the 70s and in the 60s and 70s. And now we're trying to, you know, design new buildings. How are we sure that we're not making the same kinds of mistakes, and what we think is right now isn't going to be something that people reverse in the future? So that, keep that in mind as we move forward. Here, the reason I toss this up is that in trying to answer that question, I feel like we draw inspiration from a lot of places on campus. There are great campus places, and these are some pictures that is informing what we want to do on our campus as we move forward. There are also other images of some great campus places. We'll just put a sampling, but we have a lot of great places on this campus. But also, we have places that are not so great, and we can see some of those. And so we have the two ends, and we can begin to compare, and then over time, we now know what works and what doesn't work. You have some more of some that have not worked as well. So based on that, I'd like to kind of give you some images of what we think some of our campus places could look like. And this is education project, and that's some interior and some exterior images of that building and, you know, what it might look like. So I thought I'll just toss some images there to see, based on all of the conversations we've been having, what we think, future campus places could begin to look like, based on, again, inspiration that we are drawing from parts of campuses that work really well. This is the biochemistry addition, that 1998 addition. And then if you go further, there's a building that is going in that location. That is the new Biochemistry 2 project. And it is inserted in that campus, surrounded by all these historic buildings. But We can come to that later. And these are other images of that. This is image of Wisconsin Institute for Discovery on University Avenue. Again, some ideas of what we think the campus could start looking like in some of those parts. And that's another shot of that. And actually, this is looking down. This is University Avenue. That would be Orchard, going down there. And some of the plantings and the greens would suggest softening those public high traffic areas. This is interior public space and what that might look like. That's another interior public space. And this is a palette of material from the area. Some of the kinds of materials and colors and textures that you find in that area. This is the Union South project, and you know, Sam Calvin is here today as the project manager from state. Again, I get here, that would be Campus Drive, or that would be Campus Drive, and this is Orchard. This is the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, and that is Dayton, as you could you know, see from that. And again, you know, that is just some images of models that are made. And here, this is recent development of this project. Again, Wade is right on the other side, and this is Orchard, which has become a pedestrian, or will become a pedestrian corridor and mall. And then this is, you know, the rest of the site, and you have parking on the ground. And this is the image of what this, you know, could look like from a campus drive from the northeast view of it. And this is the northwest. And this is, you know, looking an aerial view looking from the south, and this would be where you have the existing Wendt Library. And then you zoom in closer. This is the kind of experience, you know, that we want people to have when they come to this building in this part of campus. Okay. And that is that Orchard pedestrian mall, looking at that. And rather than having traffic coming through there, there's a drop-off and people go under shelter to get to the hotel entrance, you know, that is up there. Again, you know, creating more places that people can congregate and feel comfortable. Now, when we started to think about when we think about where we want to, what we want to look like and feel like in near term and long term, I think the roadmap is really, there are two components, the campus master plan and the implementation of the campus master plan. And I will not dwell on the campus master plan. We discussed that a great deal. But the master plan is only as good as its implementation. And you make it beautiful, and you hang it on the wall, and you don't present it. So through campus leadership, spearheaded by Alan Fish, and there was a sense that it was no longer acceptable just to have a campus master plan, but that something had to happen different from the way they had happened in the past, so that we can be sure that we take advantage of the opportunity that we have at this point in time, with the stars truly aligning with all the funding available and the right kind of leadership on campus and the desire to really transform our campus and make it one of the truly greatest campuses in the world. So in campus implementation, there's a design review board that is set up. That was something that we didn't have, and I'll talk a little bit about that. There was also the design review guide, you know, which we're going to talk a little bit about. And then there is the hiring of a university architect. And, you know, I'm grateful for those people who have that broad leadership, because I'm here as the university architect, because there was no better time for anyone, you know, to come and occupy such a position at an institution like this than at this particular time, with the proper alignment, I said, of stars, to just give us an opportunity to create what is truly, I believe, going to be one of the most spectacular campuses, because it's already has a spectacular setting like very few in the nation. So, as I talk about the design review guide, and the purpose of it is really to be a framework for all the conversations that must take place on campus, so that we can create the solutions that are most appropriate for our particular campus, and getting everybody involved and have everybody take ownership in that. So that's it. So it's not prescriptive. It's basically a framework for us to get to where we need to go. And our approach for the campus design guide is essentially to see our campus as a large and complex composition that is made up of smaller compositions, which we call neighborhoods. And each neighborhood, in turn, is made up of other compositions that are like buildings and open spaces, etc. And you can break it down as, you know, without end, because a building in of itself is a composition, and so on and so forth. So essentially, what we have is this complex, you know, layering of composition within composition that's just nested together. And as we see it that way, we work from out, from outside in and from inside out. If you take a look at the campus master plan, essentially the layout, it's like a tapestry of open spaces and buildings, all, you know, laid out, layered on top of one another. Here in our campus also has the added complexity that it's two campuses in one. As you could see, you have the traditional collegiate campus and the urban collegiate campus. So you within this context that you now have also, you know, the neighborhoods. And the neighborhoods have discrete characteristics which need to be understood and respected. And they depend on the scale and density or size and massing within the area, the topography, landform, or natural setting. Those are considered urban fabric, you know, the history and age, special functions, and materials. And the other thing is, if you take size as an example of buildings, you find that there are various different sizes of buildings across our campus. There are big buildings, small buildings, super large buildings, etc. And incidentally, they happen to be located in certain specific areas of campus. And that is taken into consideration as you begin to figure out the character of each neighborhood. And so you find that the small buildings are mostly by the lake shoreline, where you have the residences and so on. So there's, and then you have most of our medium and large buildings in the central core of the campus, again going east west. And then you have this area for some of the super large, you know, buildings, where you have the you know, the medical complex, and you have Camp Randall, and you have Cole Center. So, you know, you have this sort of arrangement. And so based on all of these, we have 11 neighborhoods, you know, which you kind of see laid out there. And one of the things that's really important to recognize about our neighborhoods as we want to build a campus that is, you know, has well-defined boundaries, but also read as one, that the boundaries between the neighborhoods are not just well-defined boundaries in the sense that you go from one and immediately you jump into the other. There's a fuzzy line. And the thing to note is that when buildings happen, or spaces for that matter, occur near those boundaries, and those campus places need to take on the attributes of the different, of the adjacent, neighborhoods. So one of the things that I wanted to do is to, before I get into some other aspects of the guideline, is that I take an example of a historic neighborhood of our campus and kind of run you to a little detour of, this is not the guideline, but it's a presentation about the guideline. I want to run you through what we do and we present to architects when they come, or what we want them to look at to get a sense of where they need to be going. And I look at the historic campus neighborhood, which if you go back, that would be the, that's the number 7, which is all of that area that includes the Bascom Hill. The historic campus neighborhood is the academic center. It has classrooms and faculty offices, and one of the objective is to restore a sense of scale, open space structure, building massing to more traditional campus relationships. And then what we do is to tell our story with pictures. So people see the character of the neighborhood by just a few images that give them a sense of it. So when they're doing an addition or new building or in a particular area, this frames the way they think about it, so that they are contextual in their approach to dealing with buildings on campus. And we also list the buildings in the neighborhood. This becomes just basically a resource to start their own research. But we can tell them about the buildings and relate it to the plan. So it's not just about telling them the buildings. They can actually see the images and begin to relate to those. And then we look at the open spaces in the neighborhood. And one of the things that we have, one of our mantra is that open space is as important as the buildings that help to frame them. So we can't just build buildings and neglect open spaces and expect to get a really spectacular campus. And then we deal with the massing of the area, and we take the belt and suspender approach so that it's a visual thing where we have a 3D modeling there that will show you all the buildings, and so one can place their own building in that context and see whether it's within the general massing of the area. And then we cut a section through there, and then you begin to see the buildings and also relate to the landforms. But we have the aerial photographs and some of the pictures to begin to give the person a sense of what is there. And so these are some of the things that help the architects and the designers and the project team and the campus community in general begin to appreciate what the issues are design-wise as far as new buildings and campus places are. And then we look at some side furnishings. There are certain campus-wide furnishings, and then there are neighborhood-specific furnishings. And then we also deal with the materials in the neighborhood, again, by pictures. We show them the materials that exist. And again, it's the basis for them to go out and explore some more and research those things and pay attention to what's going on and be sensitive to the details and the character of the area. And then we tell them a little bit about the architecture, and they can take it from there and explore further. And this is, again, what we call the Historic Campus West. There is the only reason for that is that we wanted to fit everything we do to one page. And so that historic campus was too long, and so we have the East and the West. That's all there is to it. And then we put this just to suggest that it's important to always look at the issues, challenges, and opportunities in a particular area in great detail as they design. And that is not something that one person comes up with. It's something that the entire team in working with us, we can come up with. And then we have a building data index that basically tells them a little bit about the histories and so on. I think it's important that people fully understand the setting in which they're working and understand a little bit about the histories and so on, so that they're not totally oblivious of what's going on before they put their own building. And then we have materials index where, again, you know, we list the materials, the description, the use, and the source of it. And now, with some of the newer buildings, the source become less important. But you know, for more traditional areas of campus, it's important. So in all of this, what's the role of the designer that we bring to our campus? I think, you know, their task is really to help us to design a very functional, sustainable building that is pleasing both at the detailed scale and at the large scale in a way that harmonizes with the neighborhood and the larger and the campus at large. And as we, the important thing for us is for designers to see that the campus needs to be approached as a whole in their thinking, where each project in of itself need to contribute to the neighborhood and contribute more than its own inherent aesthetic value, than just to the space, and then connect to the entire campus. So what we're really doing is that we assume there is a whole, and that every project basically progressively perfects it, makes it more perfect. And that's the way we're seeing it, as opposed to individual projects that have no connection to anything. So if they think along those lines, I think we'll be more successful. But we then figured that in our conversation, we wanted to talk about beauty and the aesthetics of it. You know, we have always said to the architect, it needs to be functional, it needs to be sustainable, and they understand all of that. You can follow a checklist to get you there. But the big issue is what makes it beautiful? And we wanted to have a basis for conversation. And based on all that we've studied on our campus, there are three qualities we expect, you know, that buildings will have. And, you know, one is richness, and the other is the balance, and then unity of the composition, if you see that as a composition. And we can talk a little bit more about that. That the rich composition, and again, we're telling this thing with pictures, it's about it's those examples exhibit their richness through the level of detail and the textures and the patterns and the layering of these details as they go on. And you can see it both in terms of an exterior of a building or public interior space or an open space. And I'll get to why we've picked and continue to hammer the interior space and the public open space and the exterior of a building. Those are the, and then that the there needs to be balance in the composition, you know, that we do on our campus. And that this is a notion that is more readily understood in terms of symmetry. That if you have a symmetry, then, you know, you have a balance about an axis. If you only looked at this portion of Bascom, not figuring, you have a sense that there is some sort of a visual equilibrium as you look at that. But our campus is rather asymmetrical. And so, and yet, what that does is presents us a greater opportunity for what I call, more of a dynamic balance, you know, where things are struggling with each other, and we'll figure out a way of balancing them and gives greater excitement, to the Ware campus. And that's a challenge to the architect, but that's what they have to strive to, as opposed to neglecting that. And then the sense of unity of we deal with a building like Ag Hall, and it reads as one. That's all it is. And there are some places on our campus that read as one, and there are those that don't. And the idea is that whatever we do in a new building, it needs to be unified as a composition in itself, but it also needs to help to unify the neighborhood in which it sits in that way, and tie into that. And we look at the open space, and you look at East Campus Mall. One of the other things that is key to us is to ensure that these two sides of campus also read as one. And we have really a diversity of different kinds of building styles, but we're hoping that as we pay attention to the north-south connections, and then they cross the streets, the University and Johnson, and also if we can visually appropriate the city streets through landscaping and treating them as if they were part of university open space, all of a sudden you can begin to find the ties to both sides of campus, north and south of University Avenue. And then we also value sustainability on our campus, and as we are doing more and more buildings, some of them are going for LEED, at least at the silver level. But we go beyond LEED, and LEED is just so. By way of summary of what I've just said, the way we have our strategy is essentially to say that open space is important, and those are the things that we want to kind of look at so that we see how the spaces in between buildings come together, but also that the exterior of a building is important, which tends to be what the architects tend to focus on and to the neglect of others, but also the primary interior space is important. Because again, that is where and how that is related to the patterns of movement around the site and the campus at large. Because we expect this building to be like a stage set for the people. But also, if we look at this as three by three metrics of open space and all of that on that with the qualities of richness, balance, and unity, the question would always be asked at every time that we, review a project. Is there richness in it? And what you see with some of those projects that we have shown on Bascom Hill and some of the ones we're trying to do is not about the style, but about the level of richness, that they have, how well detailed they are in the layering that you have, or the balance or the unity, the way in which it reads as one and helps to unite everything else that's around it. And then we can ask that question in each of those boxes. And that becomes a way to kind of organize our thoughts as we ask questions. The role of the Design Review Board that I mentioned is really to ask as a facilitator for those conversations. And the Design Review Board is made up of a campus community representative, and then we have two outside professionals, one landscape architect, one architect, and then I sit on the board as well. And then we have a rotational member, which is either the dean or the head of the program that sits in there. And then it's open to Alan Fish is in the room, and Gary Brown is in the room, and then DSF is represented. So it's a forum for a conversation, so that as we have this conversation, there's a buy-in, and everybody feels like they have ownership of it. When we arrive at an appropriate solution, everybody understands that we are there. And that is the process we go through as we do these projects. Now, I want to come back to the education projects and talk a little bit about the application of what we're doing. If you look at the building, education building, that's the front of the building, great building you know, from Bascom. But this is the back of the building. So there isn't a balance to start with. There isn't unity in your visual appreciation of this. You know, one looks one way and the other looks neglected. But also, we pay attention to open spaces and the spaces around buildings. We need to. Here, the back of this building is just a parking lot, you know, that sits there, and there isn't anything attractive about it. Second thing is that I've always said that this campus has a spectacular setting with 3.5 miles of lake shoreline and all the Muir Woods and 300 acres of just natural area preserve. So the lake is one of our most important resources, but the view here is to the lake, and yet, you know, there needs to be some congruence between what you're looking if you stood there and looked one way versus looking the other. And so when we started discussing this project, and Ann Monks is here, representative from education on that project, we went through all kinds of conversation about what it needs to be. There were some schemes that were simply about, you know, having a racetrack, if you will. The idea was that it functioned well for the department, but remember, or for the college. But we need to, the building needs to be functional, it needs to be sustainable, but it also needs to relate to everything else that is happening and become a part of improving and refining our campus. So it's not just about the department, it's also about the civic mission. And we can achieve all of that. We can balance all these competing needs. Well, we worked through it, and there were many other iterations, but in deference to time, I just put these three, and eventually we came up with this scheme. And I'll tell you that this scheme has a space in here that is sort of a public living room. And then it has, at the lower level here, a public lecture. But then this was the parking, and this becomes the a plaza. And the idea is that the functions inside and outside need to be related, and you need to have some drawers so that as people come in, you know, they are pulled through, or when they come outside, it's really an attractive place to be. And so this image I showed before, that will then be, that parking lot then becomes this. So it's no longer when you look, and this is the addition to the back. And this is that public living room where people can sit, and then people can appreciate the lake. There's a view that a lot of people are going to share. There is parking now underneath. Obviously, when these things happen, there are elements that go beyond just the ideas. There were some conversations that needed to take place. Alan had to get involved, and you know, when we got to that point, this would be to do this scheme would be additional $3 million. And as always, you know, mine is to dream, and then I go to Alan, you know, to come up with solutions.
I'm the bag man.
Now, again, the reason I tossed this up there is conversation about different solutions in the same part of campus. When we then did this addition, this is what we have. Before that, there was a law school addition on the same level, and this is what it is. I think it's a great design. It's a great building, but it could be more sympathetic to its environment, you know, to its context. And that's, you know, what we're, we think that if we continue to have conversations when we have jobs, and there isn't, it's never an easy thing. It's not like one person comes and speaks and that is the answer. But that as we all continue to have conversation, and we have a framework for these conversations, and we go through iterations of our design, we will ultimately come up with something that everybody says, aha, we've arrived there and we are okay with it. I'm not sure that we had all those conversations, and not that it's not a great design, but it probably better suited for a different site than here. And maybe there was something that needed. Inside, it is terrific. but we need to balance the inside and the outside, the public interior spaces and the exterior architecture, as well as the open space around, you know, the building. As I conclude, I put up these images, and what I see is a lot of energy on our campus. I see a lot of fun. I see a great place for people, you know, to gather. I think that it's important that our buildings and campus places function well and adequately meet the needs of users. I also think that we need to build sustainable buildings so that even as we meet our needs, we are not neglecting the ability of future generations to continue to meet their own needs. But it's equally important that the buildings that we build and the campus places be pleasing. Therefore, they need to possess the qualities that I mentioned: richness, balance, and unity. After all, the academy is enriched, in my opinion, intellectually and socially because it embraces diversity in all its forms. But it is unified because it has a common purpose that is centered on its mission. And then it thrives when it manages to strike a balance, a harmonious balance between unity on one side, on one hand, and diversity on the other. I think that the campus buildings and the campus places need to reflect this same ideal. So in the end, I think the way that the campus community and the visitors see our campus is extremely important. They need to perceive the campus as sublime and functional at the same time. It needs to be sustainable. And at the same time, they need to feel comfortable with it. The role of the designers that we bring to our campus is essentially to help us create appropriate stage sets for all of the plays that take place every day on our campus. And these plays or patterns of events or activities infuse our campus with energy. And I think it's important as we design buildings that they incorporate the kinds of draws that will not only support but enhance these patterns, so that ultimately our campus and all of its parts will be the place that people want to be, not just the place that they have to be. My sense is that when we succeed, that our success will influence similar transformations across the state and beyond. And I think that's the essence of the Wisconsin idea. And so I'll take some questions and we'll have conversations. Thank you.
Oh, that's you.
Thank you.
How do you want to do this?
You start, do a couple minutes, and I'll clean up.
Okay, as always. Thanks. Again, my name is Gary Brown. I'm the Director of Campus Planning and Landscape Architecture. One of my major roles in partnership with Dan is to try and implement the Campus Master Plan. And I oversee not only the master plan, but also the world between all of the buildings that we create on campus. My role is sort of the police of the landscape and the sites around them to make sure that we're remembering that these open spaces are important for us as well. The idea of design guidelines and these design neighborhoods is not something new. Actually, if you go back in the 1908 Campus Master Plan by Laird and Craig, they talked about creating neighborhoods of design, mostly surrounding the academic disciplines that the university had at the time. So if you look really hard with a discerning eye, you can see some of those neighborhoods are actually there. If you look on the Ag campus, where we have red and brown brick buildings with red tile roofs, on the engineering campus, we have a lot of Cream City brick buildings with flat roofs. If you look to the historic campus, and Dan pointed out some of these items, where we have the local Madison sandstone and red tile roofs, you see some of those characteristics of these neighborhoods sitting in the background. Unfortunately, I think in the 1960s, when we had such a huge growth of the campus, some of those ideas and design concepts were set aside just mainly for the lack of time and economics. Things were happening very quickly at that time. And also some of the architectural styles of the day were raging around campuses throughout the country. And I think some of that flavor of the international style, I guess you could say. I've heard brutalist architecture tossed around a couple times. But that style of architecture really was different from what most campuses were doing prior to that. You saw a lot of Beaux-Arts designs coming through, a lot of very classical architecture, neo-Gothic kinds of things were happening across the country. And then all of a sudden, this movement of international and minimalism was coming through. And I think we're seeing some of that in some of the campus buildings, not only here, but across the country. And a lot of campuses are struggling with that idea now as to how to handle that and how to integrate their campuses. I've talked many times about our campus being an eclectic mix of architecture. We have this very broad sense of style across the buildings. And that's not good or bad. It's what we are and what we have as far as a campus. The design guideline concept was brought back in, I think, around 1995 when the JJR master plan was developed, and there was talk then of developing design guidelines. They never really developed anything as part of that master plan. In 2005, 10 years later, when we came back and talked about doing another master plan, our consultants, Ayres St. Gross, really encouraged us to start thinking about design guidelines, and that was at the same point in time that we were talking about hiring a university architect. So as Dan came on board, it was really nice to have him really pick up that concept, take the outline that we created in the 2005 master plan, and really run with it and put some meat on the bones that we had started to develop in 2005. So again, as a partner in that crime that we're trying to create across campus, I think we've really set out a nice goal for the campus, and it's something that we're all trying to achieve.
I'm just going to talk a little bit about the last 50 years of growth on campus. If you go back to World War II, we had about 8,000 students here, I think, Art, during World War II. And when the GI Bill was passed and the veterans came back, we had a big explosion and went to 20,000 very quickly. And then when the baby boomers came in the late 50s, early 60s, we doubled again. So in part, the architectural response that these folks have talked about was really kind of a panic-stricken response to the incoming enrollment that was landing here. So you got your post-World War II architecture, which is probably, you could characterize as Quonset hut. And then
I call it cost per square foot architecture.
Exactly. And then as you dealt with the baby boomer generation, all of that generation of buildings, from Peterson Building to Ogg Hall and Van Hise, Van Vleck, were all thrown up in the 1960s, this minimalist architecture. Frankly, that design created a real functional end to those buildings that we're seeing right now. And that doesn't mean their design is ended. It means the functionality of the building is a big challenge for us. So they are some of our biggest energy hogs on campus. They are very dysfunctional for the folks who are trying to do their programs in them. They have bad circulation and heating ventilation system, bad roofs, bad glass, bad foundations, poor floor plans, very narrow floor-to-floor heights. They're very difficult to renovate. So at the end of the day, in general, what we're looking at in those buildings is it's frankly less expensive to take them down and replace them than it is to try to restore them. We're just in the opposite situation with the 100-year-old buildings that are also in need of some restoration right now because they have very good architectural bones, they have generous floor-to-floor heights, and we can go in and renovate those buildings and give them another 100 years of life. So there you see projects like Chamberlain, Sterling, Human Ecology, Mechanical Engineering, education building that Dan was showing here, of buildings that we're going to be able to give another 100 years of life for in the future. So those are the real two trends that we see going on campus as we reinvent ourselves, is replacing, ironically, the 40-year-old buildings and restoring the 100-year-old buildings that are part of our legacy. The other thing is, when you look at the big pulses of development that we've had, you had the post-World War II pulse and then the baby boomer pulse in the 60s, We went 30 years without very much building on campus from the 60s to the 90s. And Donna Shalala, I think, needs to have some credit for changing, creating a new tipping point in reinvesting in the campus, in that in the past we waited for the state to pay for every new building. And so we'd get a building every 4 years. That doesn't really do much for the overall inventory. She made a partnership with the state that if we went out and raised money, we would do more than one building. We'd do multiple buildings, and the state would only pay part of those buildings, and we would raise either gifts or grants or our own program revenue to pay for the rest of that. And so that has now elicited the third major construction boom on campus in this century. And that's what we're in the middle of right now. And so the overall approach we have is to try and take these plans, take the design guidelines and the landscape architecture, and overlay those in a way so that it's not as haphazard as occurred in the 50s and the 60s in the last two big building pulses. And we're able to control that more now also because it's mostly our own money. We have built about $1.4 billion worth of projects in the last 12 years on campus, and we've got another $600 to $800 million coming in the next 6 years. So over that period of time, we'll invest $2 billion in facilities on campus. And of that, less than a third of that money comes from the state of Wisconsin. And that's why that big pulse is achievable, is we're able to work out a partnership with the state that allows us to invest either gift and grant money or our own program revenue money from housing, athletics, the union, recreational sports into revitalizing our physical plant. So we're in the middle of that third major pulse, and we're trying to do it differently by having a master plan, having design review guidelines, and now restoring 100-year-old buildings and replacing 60-year-old buildings with buildings that will last themselves 100 years. The difference being the 100-year buildings that we restore are very difficult to work with in the interiors because they're built just solidly with really thick walls, and they're difficult to renovate. Campus is a very vital place. How we teach, how we do research changes all the time. So the new buildings we're building now are a hybrid between the 100-year-old buildings and the 40-year-old buildings. We're trying to give them a 100-year set of bones. The structures, the roofs, the heating ventilation systems are very robust. But we're trying to be more flexible in the design so that we can go in and every 20 to 40 years do interior renovation to keep up with the changing demands of what's happening on a campus. So that's the hybrid building we're building today. It's a combination of 100-year bones and more flexible interiors that can change as our demands change. Take questions.
I'm curious about
We'll have to use the microphone so we can capture your questions.
I'm curious about the scope of the 40-year-old building renovation or demolition. I mean, we've done Peterson, Aug Hall is gone.
E.B. Fred's gone.
Pardon me?
E.B. Fred is gone.
Yeah. Right. So does that list include Van Vleck, Van Hise, Humanities? What other buildings don't I like? Communication Arts Building?
I would say the ones that we identified in the master plan, we did identify Van Hise. It has some major structural issues that tell us in the next 20 years it's going to need to be replaced. It's not in the short term, but in the long term. Humanities is on the list for the same functional issue. Humanities has a different twist to it, of course, because it's a Henry Weiss design and a kind of a classic example of brutalist architecture. And the question there will be the trade-off between that exterior's aesthetic importance with its interior's dysfunctionality. Other buildings in that, the engineering research building I heard mentioned, is another building that is just not going to last more than 20 more years. We're going to have to at some point take it down and replace it. And Van Vleck is going to be more of a challenge just because you almost can't get there anymore from the standpoint of staging that. And structurally, it's in a little better shape than some of those other buildings from its heating ventilation. So down the road, there are probably the other major buildings that you're looking at replacing are really the whole collection of one-story buildings that are really not adding to the density that we need for growth on campus. So you look out on the Cal's campus and you see the Seeds and Poultry and a lot of other one-story buildings that in our master plan will become four or five-story buildings, adding a lot more capacity to campus without taking up more land. So there's a list of those projects, and in the next 20 years, they will be considered in turn as we get to them. In order to get humanities at least up for consideration, we're going to have to move music and art out of humanities because they're very specialized spaces. So we're in the process of doing that. So you see the Art Lofts project in the old Wisconsin Supply, a new music performance space being approved, and now we're raising money for that. Eventually, art faculty and music faculty buildings will have to be put in place. And then only after then will you be able to consider what you do with humanities.
Thanks. I have a question about the noise impact of the new buildings and how that is being considered as designs are made for the new ones. And I'm thinking about the impact it has in the open spaces when the ventilating systems are very loud. We had the example of the pharmacy building that was really loud, and I think some retrofitting was done on that because you could hear it on Picnic Point. So it impacted the experience of the natural areas. And then there's also the interior ventilating noise in these areas where you want social gatherings, where I think you want a pleasant atmosphere. And I think the Microcosm Cafe is a bad example because the compressor for the refrigeration unit there is really loud. So it's not a particularly nice place, I think, to have a quiet conversation.
Well, I'll start. Clearly, we've come a long way in how building exhaust systems and heating ventilation systems are being designed. The old style was just literally put the pipe up and turn on the fan and not worry about it. Over the last 20 years, we've gotten more and more high-efficiency fans in just to save energy. You should know that literally 40 to 50% of our energy bill is to blow air. It's for fans to heat and cool these buildings, 300 buildings on campus. It's not electricity. It's not lights. It's not computers. Those aren't even close compared to the amount of money we spend to move air around and keep interior space safe. So in doing that, we have now begun designing penthouses that are enclosing those mechanical equipment. Some of the buildings actually have the mechanical equipment in the building rather than on the roof. And when they do design these, they are moving more air in bigger ductwork more slowly in order to both dampen the noise, dampen the vibration, and just make it a longer lasting, sustainable heating ventilation system. So we've come a long way in our engineering approach, and then in those places where we had noisy buildings, we've gone in and retrofitted, like pharmacy, like the Wiseman Center, where we're in areas of campus where we're trying to be aware of that. You guys want to talk about some of the interior?
Yeah, but even on the exterior, sometimes we have done some noise studies for new buildings, you know, to get a sense of how noisy they could be.
And manage that.
Yeah.
But in the interior spaces you're talking about, the cafe you're mentioning was a retrofitted idea that we kind of put in there. I think as we are designing new buildings like Biochemistry 2 that Dan showed a picture of, when we remodel the old Ag Journalism building, it will have a cafe designed in the corner with a little plaza that steps out on the side. Those kinds of spaces will be designed to be a nice, quiet place to have a cup of coffee. At the same time, we get a lot of pressure for people who want to have that kind of service, and sometimes if you don't have the space but they really want the service, there's going to be a compromise.
And the example of Biochem is an example of one of those draws that we're talking about, because you need to activate buildings, and by putting those kinds of functions and cafes in there, it pulls people and gives people a nice place to gather outside
of regular, you know, classrooms. The idea is that at least there's their opportunity for interaction and for learning to take place outside of classroom.
Just want to thank Daniel. I think that was a very sophisticated presentation of what the campus is doing. And I think had we had somebody like you in place at the time the law school addition was put in place, we certainly wouldn't have that. And I agree, too, that it is a wonderful building. But we in the Department of Landscape Architecture wrote to whatever group it was on campus complaining about what was happening, not only design-wise, but also the footprint of the building extends out into the most sacred space on campus, which is Bascom Mall as well. So there was that particular issue. But of course, at that time, we had no way of any influence. So I'm really appreciate that there's a greater way for the public and the campus to interact with what's being proposed. Back then when it was done, I think it was the 80s, there just wasn't that opportunity. I'd have all sorts of questions, but I'm really going to try to limit them here. The one is, could you discuss just what's happening on the east side of Ag Hall between it and Human Ecology, where there's going to be a proposed expansion of the Human Ecology building, because there's a very important space there. It's not only Henry Mall, which we look off to the south, but there is that nice space between the two buildings. And with the new addition being proposed to Human Ecology, will there be any issues that need to be resolved? Then I'll have a follow-up question.
I think we have the issue of the spacing between the buildings so that it is rather comfortable. And we're working on that. Right now, I think the first scheme was too close to Ag Hall. But the building also is done in a way that is stepping down as it gets closer to Ag Hall. So what you see is that there is a comfortable spacing between Ag Hall and the new addition. Now, we are not done with it. That building is still going to come before the design review board one more time so that we can look at it. We review building three times. And I was just talking with Sam about that. And I think he stepped back a little. Whether that's enough or not, it's something that we'll discuss some more. I don't know if you want to say something, Sam.
Talk about that landscape.
Okay.
I just wanted to comment on the site design and the spacing around it. One of the things I've been adamant about is trying to maintain what was originally called the Greater Mall. This was laid out in the 1908 Laird and Cray Master Plan. And if you look at the setback from Linden Drive to Human Ecology and Ag Hall and how far back they're set up against the hillside, one of the things we've tried to do in the addition proposed for Human Ecology is keep the front of that building or the south facade back towards that same kind of setback so it doesn't penetrate down into what was the Greater Mall. So that as you stand up on Bascom Hill and you start to make your way down the hill and look to the west, that setback is still maintained of green space there. Now there will be some penetrations to that as you get as you approach the building. We need to provide some fire access, some sidewalks. There's an underground parking garage that's planned as part of that. So there will be penetrations through that. But I think the architects have worked really hard to try and keep that building back behind that setback that we've given them.
I know that Sam has a response to that. Could I ask an entirely unrelated question since I'm back here? With the economy going into the tank, now I would imagine that state funding is going to dry up almost completely. And also with all of the funding that private agencies and individuals have probably declining as well, do you see all of the projects that you have proposed and on the drawing boards coming to fruition in the same time frame that you had projected? And will there really be a decline in the future as all these potential funds may begin to dry up?
Well, it's probably two answers to that, Arnie. First of all is probably the things that we've got in the pipeline for the next 4 years, most of them are already approved and funded. So in the short term, you're not going to see any immediate fallout from this particular economic crisis. From a state investment standpoint, the argument we're making with the executive branch is that construction of state projects is a counter-cyclical thing. And when we are in the tank like we are financially, having a capital investment that the state makes at this time may be the most important thing to not only achieve some of the infrastructure goals that we have for our campus, but also to keep Wisconsin design and construction companies alive. And we pay for these buildings over 20 years. So it's hard to imagine that we're going to be in this much trouble for 20 years. We're in this much trouble right now. But trying to keep that construction-based economy strong is really critical to the state of Wisconsin, because in the last 10 years, we have never built a building that wasn't constructed by a Wisconsin firm, ever, not one, on this campus. We really want to keep that record, and what will happen is if we don't keep some level of investment in the capital budget, some of those firms are going to be gone, design firms and construction firms. And that will be a permanent loss to our economy and to the flexibility of us keeping those jobs supporting our projects. So we have a strong argument to make to try and keep some level of state investment. And in the next 4 years, most of our projects are already funded. So we just need to get through this trough and try and come out on the other side so that we don't have a big dip. And my expectation is this is going to be harder, but we have a lot of momentum going right now. And hopefully, as we come out of this trough in the next 18 to 24 months, we're going to be in better shape. But while we're in that trough, the other argument to build things is that there's more competitive bidding now for these projects than there has been in the last decade. And we believe we will see prices actually come down as people are very desperate for work. And that means there's no better time for investing in infrastructure, if you can afford it, than right now.
I'd like to make several comments to a lot of the things that were said with regard to things. First of all, a general comment with regards to why some of the buildings that were built in the 50s, 60s, and 70s are the way they are. One of the things you have to understand from a historical perspective is as the went into the Industrial Revolution and as there was a reaction to the Beaux-Arts School of Design, the modern movement began to emerge, and therefore we began to get such phrases as form follows functions and less is more. And as a consequence, we began to lose some of that richness that Dan is talking about in all of those buildings, and they became skeletons as opposed to necessarily buildings that had sinews and flesh and muscle and everything else that was put to them. And as a consequence, created some of the problems that you talked about earlier with regards to those buildings. The other thing that was coupled with that was that we were under the false assumption that nuclear energy by the year 2000 would essentially give us free energy. There would be a vast amount of energy and it would be relatively inexpensive. And that was well before the Earth Day of the 70s that showed us that we simply were flat out wrong. And I think that one of the things that was great about that is that it made us realize, and this is the first step in making any kind of corrections, is to realize that you did make a mistake. And I think we're in a position now where we realize that we did make mistakes in the past and that we need to correct some of those in order to have a sustainable future. The other thing I want to talk a little bit about the sound situation, much of the sound situation is perceptive. So what we did at IRC, which has now been renamed to the Wisconsin Institutes of Medical Research, is that we actually went into Shorewood Hills and we did sound readings prior to construction. Both the hospital, the pharmacy building, Wiseman, and all of those things, we actually have actual data of what was produced prior to construction. I anticipate that probably as we began to get closer and closer to completion of the IRC, the Wimmer project, that we will go back and do a post-evaluation as well. And so, therefore, we'll actually have hard data to look at as opposed to somebody's perception as to whether or not we added or subtracted sound. Now, it may turn against us. I don't know. We may have added sound, whatever, but at least we'll have some actual data. Also, with regards to the space between Egg Hall and the new addition of the School of Human Ecology, one of the things that's given us fits there is the Madison Fire Department access, and that is between fire access and fire lanes. One of the things that we've had several meetings with them, and one of the things that we were recently able to negotiate was that rather than have a fire
a lane immediately east of Ag Hall, they accepted a fire access, which means that we, instead of having a 26-foot wide pavement area, we could go down to a 20-foot wide pavement area, which allowed us to add 6 feet of landscape area immediately at the base of the east end of Ag Hall. The other thing that we did was that we worked to try and shorten the building somewhat so that the building, there was a little bit more space between Ag Hall and the west end of the addition to the School of Human Ecology, and we're still working on that. So far, we've been able to shorten it about 10 to 12 feet over the previous design, and as they mentioned before, some of the step downs. The other thing that we're working with on that is that with regards to the mechanical systems, we have been oscillating back and forth between a full penthouse on the roof of the addition. And when we talk about a historic district and trying to maintain the massing and the scale and all those things, those are practical things that we have to consider. One of the things that we're looking at now is the possibility of moving those mechanicals into the basement level or the parking level of the addition, if at all possible, and maintaining that scale between Ag Hall and the existing School of Human Ecology. All of that is evolving, and I can't promise anything at this point, but all of those things are things that we're looking at in the current design, and that we'll even be discussing as early as tomorrow on some of those changes as well.
Thank you. You know, Sam, and going back to Arnie's point and some of the other questions is, without the master plan and the design review guideline and the design review board approach that we have for these projects, there wouldn't be a vehicle for these conversations to have. It would always be about a particular dean building his or her building, and that would be the only focus. There wouldn't be a campus overlay of how this fits into the rest of the structure. And that's the added, that's the difference in the last 5 years compared to what we've done maybe 20, 30 years before, where every building, as you can see on campus, was put up with its own sponsor in control of the design and the spaces around that building. And now we're trying very hard to have a campus voice in there as well.
Let me throw out a question. That is, at one time I served on the campus planning committee, at one time I served on the city's urban design commission and the city council. And back in those days, the city would frequently say, the campus doesn't have its act together as it relates to the matrix, Dan, that you've working with the campus community design. It's fabulous. I applaud you and your team. So my question is there an understanding or even an acceptance by folks off campus, because you do have to go through, in some cases, interact with both the plan commission and the urban design commission, ultimately city council, from that perspective. So my question is there an awareness and acceptance by those parties, and the challenge will be, how can you address the fact that alders change every 2 years and committee appointments get changed? So I'm just curious how you are wrestling with that very important question.
Yeah, I think I'll make some comments, and Gary will speak to some others. With respect to there are layers of reviews that that we deal with, and Gary works with community groups and they see what we do. But we also have another review that's been there, which is the state review, and that was one that almost promised to be sort of a conflict if it wasn't managed. And we sat down with the state and basically said, we want to pay attention to how we implement our campus master plan, and we want to work out a way to do it so that we don't have conflicting messages. And so what we've agreed with the state is that we go through all of our, the state has a peer review, what they call the peer review. And what we do is that we do all of our three reviews, design review, by the design review board, and at the end of it, then they schedule their peer review. But also, we have the state representative, in this case, say, in the projects that Sam in, attend the design review board. And I go to the peer review. So what we tend to do is that after we've done our reviews, we have a minute of the meetings, which we send to all the stakeholders, including the state. So they see the decisions that we have made and the guidance that we have given, and it contains all the conversations that went through there. And what we have found by doing that is that it eliminates the conflict. And in a lot of cases, in fact, in all the cases since we started doing that, we found that they concur, with, the decisions or the guidance that the Design Review Board has provided. And that's how we're dealing with that. I think Gary can talk about Urban Design Commission. We don't have any direct arrangement with them. There was a conversation that Alan had started to have with the city, and I think he can talk about that. But I'll say so far we've lucked out, because everything that has gone through campus design review and gone to the Urban Commission has actually been accepted so far in the recent. And recently, the Union project that I just showed you went in there for a preliminary review, and they were so enamored by it that they gave it a final approval. From that perspective, we can count that it will always happen that way, but I think it's a testament to what we're doing, that we're paying good attention to the designs. And when so many people come together and find a design appropriate to our campus and aesthetically pleasing, we have found that other people outside have found that to be true as well so far. But I think at some point we'll have to have some sort of formal conversation continued. So, Gary?
Yeah, having served on and chaired the Urban Design Commission, I have some intimate knowledge of their inner workings, which can be interesting at times. I'm sure, Noel, as a member, you experience some of that as well. We are lucky enough to have 7 neighborhoods around us that we work with on a almost monthly basis, sometimes even more frequently than that. Those 2 different groups that we have formed for those, we have the Joint West Campus Area Committee and the Joint Southeast Area Committee that are made up of representatives of each of those neighborhoods, as well as city staff and university staff. Those 2 groups meet on a regular basis, usually monthly, sometimes every other month, depending on our agendas. But that's a way for us to communicate with the neighborhoods and the alders. There's alders represented on those committees as well, to keep them informed of what we're doing on campus. Both groups were intimately involved in the 2005 master plan process. We worked with them hand in hand throughout the whole development of the master plan, so they're aware of what's going on and where we're going. But now they're also in the process of helping us implement a lot of the buildings. So they're aware of, I remember when we developed a master plan, when we talked about those areas. Now this project is coming forward and we can develop the details of that. That's been very, very helpful for us as we've gone through the approval process, not only on campus, but within the city agencies as well. I mean, both of those committees have been very, very helpful for us. One of the other things that's going on right now is the city is developing a new zoning code, and I sit on the zoning code revised committee that's been formed for that. They are talking about, and what we have been talking with the city about for the last decade, is to develop an institutional zone or a university zone as part of the zoning plan for the city, and that's actually coming to fruition. And not only the university here, but Edgewood College and some of the other major institutions will be part of that. That will be hopefully the first stepping stone to allowing us to ease back on some of the approval process. And we're just starting to work out some of the details of that as part of that overall zoning code revision.
Question, but just looking at the new designs, you see a lot of glass, and then there are these signs all over campus about energy savings. Are those mutually compatible?
Yes. What we do with the new buildings is that we do actually have energy modeling for the new buildings, and it is not such that all glass is bad. There are some glass that it has better insulation, but we model the buildings, and also with some of the buildings that we do, depending on where the glass is, you want more glass on the south side and be able to get in some light in the winter, or we in some cases we need northern light because it's better for the task that you do in the building. But what we try to do is that we commission energy modeling, because there is actually a code that we have to abide by. All of our buildings have to be designed to be 30% more energy efficient than the current code allows. That is Executive Order 145 by the governor. So all of these buildings that you see are actually 30% better savings than the code, available code, which is what's called ASHRAE 90.1. So even though you see the glasses, they are being used in a fashion that still allows us to save energy and at the same time allow us to gain light into the building where we need it. So we don't have to have artificial lighting all the time when we could be using natural light.
Fascinating presentation. And I've been on campus for 30 years. It's very surprising to me that we haven't had an architect and a design board reviewing all these buildings. The pictures you see up on the PowerPoint was my neighborhood 30 years ago when I started working in the School of Education. My neighborhood now is engineering. I've been there 20 years. And I wish it looked like this. You know, we're concerned with the community, but we're also concerned with our neighborhoods. And engineering has been very, very lucky in the buildings that we've had put up recently with the Institute of Discovery also, and Union South is going to be a tremendous asset to that end of campus. I'd like to add one more texture when you were describing engineering as Cream City brick.
Yep, that's a Milwaukee-based brick that was developed.
And flat roofs. I would also like to add aluminum to that with Engineering Hall especially. I think that that end of campus needs a little bit of warmth, and I'm not quite sure if Cream City brick, what we can work with there. As you're approaching ERB, I would hope that you would not only look to the east, to the Institute of Discovery and Union South, but also look to the immediate west of mechanical engineering. It's a beautiful building. It's beautiful. And if there would be some way of combining the new architecture with reverence for that old architecture, I would feel very happy about that. The other thing to remember in our neighborhood in engineering is that there's a lot of energy inside every one of those buildings. The students in the 10 disciplines in engineering are doing amazing work, as are the professors, but it's flat outside on that whole campus. So I don't know if that needs more green space, more trees. We could take a mini Lake Mendota on that side of campus. A lake or a lake shore would be nice. We've often mentioned green space that is not being used too much on that end of campus, and that's next to the athletic facility where the soccer team practices. It used to be the football team practice. It's gated. People sneak in there in the wintertime to build snowmen once or twice a year. But that area is underutilized for the campus. I'm not quite sure how we can coordinate something with the athletic department to make that into something open, a skating rink. I mean, anything that would gather, I guess, some energy outside would be wonderful there. What else did I write down? I think the three things that Dan mentioned, richness, balance, and unity, are tremendous goals to achieve. And on that end of campus, I know we're techies. I know that, you know, we need to keep this real technical, clean aspect to the interiors of our buildings. But to the exteriors, I think it would be tremendous if we could bring some more of that balance, unity, and richness to the outsides of the buildings.
Or you want to talk about the town square idea?
Yeah, there's a couple of projects that are happening, and I just want to pick up on some of your comments about the characteristics of the buildings. If you notice in some of the Union South images that we have there, we actually are using a combination of building materials, not only the Cream City brick, but also some stone and some red brick materials as well. So that's starting that blending concept that you talked about. Several site projects are in the works in that area. One is both of them are really related to the new athletic performance facility that we're planning between Engineering Hall and the Lot 17 ramp. One of them is finishing out Engineering Drive, which has always been a concept that we've wanted to do ever since we built the Lot 17 parking ramp, and finish out the site development between Mechanical Engineering, Lot 17, ECB. That whole area has sort of been waiting for something to happen as we've used it for a staging area for the last 10 to 12 years. That'll all come in through with the Athletic Performance Facility, as well as a concept that we're calling Badger Way, which is from Dayton Street through the Memorial Arch at the Camp Randall Memorial Park, and then that whole space running between Engineering Hall and the McLean Center. That whole space will be redeveloped as a new pedestrian way from the east through the athletic complex all the way actually to Breeze Terrace. Widmere is another building that you mentioned. We are looking at Cream City brick colors in that. There's actually not too much brick on the building, but there's terracotta on it, and some of those colors are actually picking up some of the warmth of the Ag campus and bringing that down. So it's not actually, there's a mix of cream and some Kasota limestone, as well as this sort of, I would say, warm buff color to it, I think, that is a little different than the Cream City brick, but starts, as I said, bringing in some of the Ag campus colors and that more warmer tones. It's hard to get away from the aluminum colors. Yeah. I've heard it referred to as champagne before, which I haven't quite figured out, but there are some tones to the mullions and some of the window trim pieces that I think we're starting to look at as well.
Yeah.
And I said, I think it's just terrific that you're doing this and looking at this.
And the other thing is that if you saw the biochem, you know, that with Mir is also picking up on, you know, some of that, you know, light tower that goes in the middle, using terracotta as well as they're using. So the whole sense of it is give a visual sense of unity, you know, so you can see some relatedness as you kind of come through there to the extent that we can. And then, but the open space is really the key because, yes, we have an eclectic mix of style, but that is a great thing. I mean, when we talk about, you know, the unity and diversity and the harmony, you know, that you want to, you know, the balance you want to strike between. I love the fact that we're not exactly one style throughout. I think that diversity gives it, you know, some, makes it rather interesting. The question is, how do we have that? And at the same time, have a sense of unity. And I think our open space holds the key to that. And that's why we, you know, we keep emphasizing that all the time, yeah.
I'll give you an example of the East Campus Mall that we're developing now from Library Mall all the way down to the Kohl Center. You'll see pieces of that already done. And that is taking a wide variety of buildings from residence halls to the Kohl Center to the Elvium to the Mitchell Theater, Vilas, Gordon Commons, University Square. They're all linked up, and in 3 years, all the way from Library Mall to Regent Street, that mall will be done. And so it'll be a connective north-south courtyard, if you will, for six blocks. It's that kind of a treatment that we're thinking of for the connection in the engineering campus from engineering centers down to Engineering Hall, and then from behind Camp Randall. Is that it's just not a wasteland of asphalt. It is, it's, you know, a combination of concrete, probably stamped concrete so it looks like pavers, clear pedestrian areas and courtyards, clear areas where vehicles are supposed to go, probably some bollards that are attractive that kind of keep safe zones in those areas, trying to make it feel like more of a town square than a big wasteland of asphalt. So the first example of that is happening right now in the East Campus Mall. If you go right out in front of the University Square, that part is just about done. If you don't down by the Surf and the Kohl Center, that part is just about done, as examples of what that kind of collegiate courtyard can look like.
I really enjoyed your presentation, the mixture of concept and design. I saw yours the other day, too. I really enjoyed it. I had to leave before the Q&A. I just want to comment really quickly and add another viewpoint, because I think I worry sometimes, like when I look at the new education building, the fusion of styles, I think that one thing that I do like about seeing the aluminum, the steel, is that it represents a forward thinking. You have to think about how a building is going to look in 20 to 30 years. Is it going to look progressive? And sometimes a fusion of styles, when you're trying to refer to this, to an older style too much, it causes confusion also in the landscape. It doesn't hold up. It's gorgeous what's going on with Union South. I'm very excited about that building because I think it's a great representation of where a fusion works really nicely. In terms of, I mean, I just want to notice, I know this is partially the photo library, but when we look up at the screen, we see that, you know, adding to what you're saying, the most vibrant areas is this lakefront. And so I really have a conceptual question, because I went to the law school here and we never use the backside of the building where there's an open space. I'm also a PhD student in English and we absolutely never use that front area of Helen C. White. Conceptually, what brings people to a space to use it? Because the ones that are really being used is the campus mall area and Bascom Hill and then the lakefront. And so what do you do to draw people around a building into that space?
Yeah, the very good question, and thank you. I think we started really struggling with that a great deal when we look at campus. One of the things that that struck me is when I, the most exciting places for me would be the Union Terrace or State Street. I just like people, I came from New York, and I just, you know, liked, you know, coming, popping out of Grand Central Station and having all these people. But then I also figure out that there are places where people are that are really nice places and people hang out. And it struck me that, you know, that we needed to have things that draw people to a place. And so what are those things? When we were doing Wisconsin Institutes for Discovery, we had a workshop with a program for public spaces and basically said there are some really successful public spaces where people are drawn to. What are the kinds of things that would draw people to a place? Because indeed, the energy of a place is wrapped up in the people that come and use the place. So we can do beautiful buildings, but we want to also make sure that there's energy in the place. And so we talked about the concept of drawers. So it's not one thing, but many different things that can draw people to a place because it becomes both a destination and a vibrant path to something. And so when we looked at Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, which is also the same thing we're dealing with in the Union, what are the kinds of functions that would make it both a destination and a path through? And if people come in as a path, is there a way to get for them to get from the Union to some other places? And if you have functions, some of which you program, some are just things that are there that would be food, you know, that people really like to go to, or it would be post office where people will go to. But if you have a number of these things happening in one place where you come in for one thing, but you can do something else and something else, the concept of triangulation, then you will draw people to that part of campus. The real question is, how can we work out the arrangements within campus? For instance, if you have the kind of food that people want to eat, not necessarily what is everywhere else, that may be a location. So that was discussed at the Union. There is also discussed at both the Union as well as the at WID. There is also the Outreach Center for the WID that would bring lots of people there, like kids, K through 12. But there is also a town center that will have programmed events. So when you have multiple events that take place that bring people, and you make it a comfortable place as well, there may be need for people to actually hang out there longer. And I go back to New York and use the Grand Central Station and Penn Station. and I go through Penn Station, I don't want to stay. I just want to keep going. It's a place you have to be. You go to Grand Central, you know, you come out, you want to linger, you hang out. There are places to food. There are all kinds of things going on. You need to be there, but you also want to be there. And I think that's the thing that we are trying to create. That's a lot more difficult to do, but at least we are thinking about it. We're not just building buildings, and we are having those conversations. And then with respect to education, you know, the comment, I think that the union itself has some metal, but metal of different colors. And again, what we want is to make sure that you have warmth in the things that you design. Education itself is a modern building, but it's a modern building that is consistent, you know, with what is going there. It's not something that's so totally different because somebody wants to make a statement that photographs were wins award, you know, for the architect, but really for the people that go there, it does nothing for the campus. I think that, I really think that education, when it's all done, would be one of those series of wow experiences that you get to on campus because, again, it's a place that people can gather. The one of the big draws there is that you have a huge lecture room, you know, that will be scheduled and people will come in. But if there is something interesting enough for them to hang out, their tables and chairs, they can sit and eat their lunch, then they may linger, you know, and over there. And then there's a path that that goes from up the street and crosses there right now. So you have quite a bit of traffic going down either towards the Union or Helen C. White. Again, if we get an opportunity to do something with any of those buildings, like Helen C. White, then we will think more about the kind of draws we need to put in that area. But open space is also very important because if it's comfortable enough for people to hang out, I think they will.
It really is about creating the physical space that people enjoy and like to use. At education, one of the things Dan mentioned is that we're creating not only this lecture room and this common space, but an outdoor space as well, where we're going to have tables and chairs and benches and seating areas and places that people are going to feel comfortable in. There's a small scale trees that provide some shade, and it's about creating human scale spaces, places that people feel comfortable in. If you're out in that big plaza by Helen C., it's not comfortable. There's no human scale there. It's not that it's a nice, big, grand space, which it is, but it's just not comfortable for people to be out there. We've put a few tables and chairs out there. People are starting to use them, but there's still no mid-story cover that people feel protected in. And I would love to put some trees out there, but it's all over a parking deck, and maybe there's a way for me to do something. But out here at Granger Hall, we just did just that. We put in some planters with some low-scale plantings over the parking garage and added some benches and trash receptacles and tried to create more of a space for people to hang out in, and people are starting to use that. Before, it was just this big urban wasteland on the north side of the building, which was cold and uninviting, and people sort of hurried from the sidewalk into the building to try and get through that space. And now there's a place for them to sort of linger and use, and we're trying to create more spaces like that throughout the campus.
Before you finish, I'd just like to acknowledge at Hovey, you know, who is here. At Hovey is one of the members of the Design Review Board. He's just keeping quiet, so I just thought I'd, you know. All right.
We'll take one more question because it's just past our time, and I apologize, but they may linger, so if you have some follow-up questions.
Talk about the engineering campus. It's great to have places people want to be, but I actually think having the pedestrian experience be a metric, a key metric, in how the master plan is being done or decisions that are made is very, very important. I hear it kind of being a theme, but not that movement, that pedestrian metric that makes European cities wonderful, makes great campuses, the East Campus, but engineering campus, you know, West Campus are horrible places to walk around. Outdoors, between buildings, and I hope that can become an important part of how we measure what we're doing and our goals with landscaping and everything.
It actually is one of the big pieces as part of the master plan, and one of my goals sometime is, if we ever slow down in our building boom here, is to come up with a more detailed landscape master plan to look more closely at these neighborhoods and think about the spaces in between the buildings with a little bit more detail, looking at where we're planting trees, where we're creating these courtyards, how can we do that? The master plan talked about adding more trees in the area south of University Avenue in the urban street grid just to slow traffic down, to provide more of an enclosed space and try and keep people moving through that space in a more regular way. We'd like more people to interact along those streetscapes. We had design concepts for University Avenue, and just so you know, next year University Avenue is going to be reconstructed. So if you're planning on moving around campus, that's going to be an interesting time. But one of the things that the city has said that they won't do as part of that is add trees and try and deal with that pedestrian space along there because of their funding capabilities and their ability not to do things outside the right-of-way. So I would love to do that. Right now, we just don't have the funding mechanism to do any more. But I do want to get into this idea of a landscape master plan and looking at each of these neighborhood open spaces much more detail.
And the other thing we're doing with specific little building projects is to enrich the pedestrian experience by bringing people through buildings so that in inclement weather, people feel like, they can actually walk and be protected as they're going. And we're doing it with Union South, we're doing it with WID. And so as much opportunity as we have, we're thinking along the lines that you're proposing, yes.
Great, well, I wanna thank Daniel, Gary, and Alan for your wonderful presentation and for all the work you've done, as well Art Hovey, the quiet person in the background. Thank you very much for the presentation, and have a good day, everyone.
Thank you.